Well, we are told that this celebrates the birth of Jesus Christ. Well, is that really true? I think all of us will recognize and understand that is not the case. Does anyone really know, or does anyone even care to know, the truth about all the customs that we see around us in celebration, as the world does around us, of this season of the year? Mankind seems to be saying that, well, I don't want to hear it. Don't tell me these things. I really don't want to know. So maybe we should ask ourselves here, well, how well do we know and understand why we do not keep Christmas? We all know, I think, most of us here, and have known that I don't keep it, but how well from the scriptures do we understand it? Can we give an answer for the hope that lies within? Well, I want to take a look at some of these things here today. I thought, since it is the day before the big event of the year for this world, that I would share some things with you. I have gone over and looking at some, I'm not going to spend time going through and reading from some of the books I've had used in the past when I've talked on this subject. The Two Babylons, Babylon Mystery Religion, The Golden Bough, 4,000 Years of Christmas, all of those I've quoted from in the past. But I thought I would do a little something different because, as you know, I like to get up, my wife and I, and have our coffee and read the paper. And so, guess what? The newspaper was doing a little work for me this year to helping me out. So that I thought was very good. And also, Jim Cannon sent me an email. Maybe, I don't know if he sent it to some of the others around here or not. But this is a very interesting Charlie Brown cartoon that I don't know if it was in a newspaper or where it was, but I got it over the sent to me. Did you get that too? Yeah, it's very interesting. So Charlie here asks, is there anyone who understands what Christmas is all about? Sure, I can tell you what Christmas is all about. I'm not sure if the friend here has a name or not, but anyhow, he begins to tell him. Well, December 25th is associated with the birth of many pagan gods, including Mithra, Horus, Hercules, Zeus, and Sol Invictus. The Roman festival Saturnalia would also end around this time. Christianity imported many of these pagan myths and traditions into its own customs around 400 A.D. Today, Christians express outrage that Christmas is losing its Christian roots. This is ironic since it was Christianity that hijacked the holiday in the first place to make it easier to convert new followers. Nevertheless, every year church-going Christians unknowingly put up ancient Babylonian fertility symbols called Christmas trees in their homes without ever asking how the tradition got started in the first place and not knowing that their own Bible warns against this practice. Jeremiah, cited here chapter 10, verse 1 through 5. That's what Christmas is all about, Charlie Brown. It was very interesting and put it in a cartoon. So I guess you could have to show you where you can go to see that. And you might, if you're on your own computer, you might be interested. Oh, that was quite cute. But I don't know the man's name who does Charlie Brown, but I guess he's still employed. for who is it? Oh, okay. Oh, but he's died, hasn't he? And he was Church of God Seventh Day? Huh. Learned something new every season. That was a new one on me. That's interesting. Now, from the Fort Myers News Press, this is, let's see, this would have been Wednesday. Get ready for the shortest day of the year. And, of course, that was at 12:30 a.m. Thursday night. The winter solstice came in. I didn't get up to see it, but I about 6:30 went out and got the paper while it was still dark and looked up at the new moon up there. That was very interesting. I usually don't see the new moon that much, but I had read the article the day before, and somehow, oh, yeah, that's right, solstice and all this, and somehow it's associated with the moon. Well, I'm just going to, the first part of this article is talking and explaining what is the solstice and how the earth is off of its axis 23.5 degrees and it will tip south for summer, and if you're living in the northern hemisphere and north as it's doing now for the winter. So it's gone as far as it's going to tip north. Now it's going to begin to gradually come back. All right. Now, breaking in here after that explanation, this naturally leads us to the Christian part and raises the question, why is Christmas on December 25? Well, and that question leads us to pagan part and more solstice stuff. Long before the first Christmas, many pagan societies celebrated the winter solstice, knowing that after the first day of winter, the days would get longer and spring was right around the corner. Among the hardiest of winter solstice partiers were the Romans, who celebrated the season with a week-long festival called Saturnalia, named for Saturnus, god of the harvest. And this was a rowdy celebration indeed, according to the poet Lucian of Samosatos, I guess is how you say it, or Samosata. During Saturnalia, the Sirius is barred. No business is allowed. Drinking and being drunk, noise and games and dice singing, naked, clapping of frenzied hands. And then it says out here, it sounds a little like Fantasy Fest. That's a, this writer writes. Which brings us back to Christmas. Nobody knows the date of Jesus' birth. Very honest. So during the early years of Christianity, the church didn't celebrate it. Easter was the big Christian holiday in the early years, they say. But in the 4th century, Pope Julius I proclaimed that Jesus had been born on December 25, which happened to be the final day of Saturnalia. The church made the day a holiday originally called the Feast of the Nativity, even adopting some of the rowdy Saturnalia practices. Now, depending on who's telling the story, the church made December 25 Christmas either to Christianize Saturnalia or to convert pagans by allowing them to celebrate Saturnalia while still being good Christians. For most modern people, the winter solstice is little more than an intellectual curiosity because we're just not as tuned in to the change of seasons as the ancients were. But here's another intellectual curiosity. What if Julius I had decided to put Jesus' birth on the summer solstice during the festival of Summinus, I guess is how you say it, the Roman god of nocturnal thunder? For one thing, a whole new tradition of Christmas songs would have evolved. The one about being home for Christmas wouldn't include the line, "Please have snow and mistletoe." And Jack Frost wouldn't be nipping at your nose, and nobody would be dreaming of a white Christmas, at least not in the Northern Hemisphere. So, kind of cute. Well, a lot of people out there do know about these customs, obviously, as they write about them, and even here this author of the Charlie Brown cartoon did, which is interesting when you see those type of things. But what about the true story? Why don't we take a look at the true story of what did take place and see what we can learn from it, what it says and what it does not say. The birth of Christ is given in two books and two chapters. That is Matthew chapter 2 and Luke chapter 2. One tells one situation that took place. The other tells something else. So let's look at it and see if we can't learn some things about this particular time and season of the year. And I want to go to Matthew chapter 2. I'll begin with Matthew's account. Now, Matthew's account is the one where the wise men see the star and they come. And Herod wants to know about it, and when he finds out that they have fled town without telling him where this child is, then he kills the boy babies up to 2 years of age. And we'll see in Luke's account, we have the taxation is listed by Luke, time of taxation. And also the shepherds in the field, the angels appear to them and tell them about it. But neither one of them has the same information. They don't duplicate the information. Matthew is the one who wrote his letter first, then Mark and Luke, and then John was last. And actually, they're in the order of the way that they were written as far as how they appear in your Bible. There's some things about Matthew's account that I'll mention here. One thing is the quote, higher critics, and of course doubt his account because they can't find any secular evidence to show that Herod killed the children. Well, so in other words, he made it up, I guess is what their conclusion would be, because they can't find it. Well, there's a lot of things you can't find a secular, non-biblical evidence for. But the details of the story are such that it's hardly anything that is made up. And I'll show you when we go to Luke's account where Matthew may have got the information that he wrote, because Luke tells us his source. So in chapter 2 is where I want to begin in the book of Matthew, and we'll just have a little Bible study and go through a couple chapters here and some other scriptures later. Verse 1, now after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king. Well, why was, since his parents, as you will see later in the second chapter, their home is in Nazareth. So what are they doing in Bethlehem? Well, we would not have any clue, would we, unless we saw Luke's account. Because in Luke chapter 2, he tells us why they came to Bethlehem, but Matthew does not. And he just simply says they were there. So what you do in the Bible, you put the two stories together. They complement one another. You don't subtract one from the other, and as some people try to do, and say, well, it contradicts itself. No, it does not. Luke, who wrote after Matthew, included things in his story that Matthew did not. And he cites really his source of information. I'll just tell you who the source was. It's Mary. Because everybody else was dead by the time they would be writing this. Mary lived on. Remember, Jesus told John when he was on the cross to take care of his mother. And she lived for many, many years and before she passed away. But I'll show you a couple verses in Luke's account, which shows that he was speaking with and getting the information from Mary. Joseph was dead before Jesus began his ministry. His younger brothers, because Christ was the firstborn, and then after that was James, and he had, what, three or four brothers. They're given by name there in Mark 6 and in verse 3 are the list of his brothers afterwards. Sometime after having about seven children, counting Christ, because he had sisters, plural, so he had to have at least two sisters, and I believe it was four brothers, plus Christ as well. That's seven children Mary had. She may have had more. Could have been more than two sisters. It just says sisters, doesn't give their names. Sometime after that, Joseph died between the remainder of the children. And you got a question for me? I don't know if I'm going to. Depends on questions. I'll see if I can get to that. What are the seven spirits of God? Well, I don't know. It doesn't say what the seven spirits of God is. I'll have to look at that. But take a little bit more time on that. Let me get back here to what I'm getting into. So Mary then was really the main source of the birth of Christ, actually for both of them. Matthew wrote Matthew in the 30s A.D., probably somewhere around 37 A.D. by the time that he wrote. And he was writing to a Jewish audience. Okay, let me go along here in chapter 2. Now after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem. Where? China? Japan? Indonesia? No. Parthia from the east. You will read in Josephus, I didn't write it down to give you the quote, but I think I've used it in the past, in Antiquities of the Jews, Josephus mentions of the 10 of the tribes that were taken into captivity, that there were a number of them had become really quite a nation called Parthia, east of the Euphrates. Now, when you look at history of the Parthian Empire, now remember that the northern tribes were taken into captivity by the Assyrians 720 B.C. How old is this country? Are we 200 and what, 25? Let me got to stop and think here. Subtract back. We're coming up on 250 years here in 2026, isn't it? So we're very close to that. We began as a very small country of 13 colonies. By 1800, after we had won our independence, I believe the estimated population was it 8 million? I think that's what it was. Where are we now? We're in excess of 300 million despite all the wars we have fought and the killing off of many, many people that has taken place in the last 200 years. What happens in 700 years? See, that's almost three times what we are as a nation of time that has gone by. Well, the Parthian Empire had really grown considerably, and the Romans were stopped at the Euphrates. Every time they tried to challenge the Parthians, they defeated them. It wasn't until 221 A.D. that the Parthians were defeated by the Romans. And up until that time, they were a very, very strong empire. And as Josephus said, that's where the tribes were as he understood it at that time. Now, why would I say that? Because there is no scripture that says that the wise men came from Parthia. They came from the east. Usually from the east meant east of the Euphrates River, where they would be coming from when they came from the east. Because of what they were coming for. They saw a star, and they're coming here in verse 2 and saying, "Where is he who has been born king of the Jews?" Now, if they were not in some way related, why would they even care? If it's people that have no knowledge of the Old Testament and no knowledge of their past, why would they care? Jews, who are they? It means nothing to them. But it meant something to these three men. And wise men, I don't know, wise in what? Were they, people speculate that they may have wise in astrology or something like that. Well, they obviously were wise to an extent of knowing something about what we call the Old Testament. Or otherwise, when they saw the star, how would they have interpreted this thing? That it meant that to follow it, that we want to see where the king of the Jews has been born. Well, the Jews were nothing. They were a captive people. The Romans conquered them. So they knew something about the Messiah, and the one that was prophesied in the Old Testament to come. Now, it says, "And for we have seen his star." Now, sometimes people have tried to say that, there was some star out here that they followed. Well, the Bible tells us, and if we let it interpret itself, Revelation chapter 1 and in verse 20, that a star is an angel, symbolic of an angel. And that's why we have always considered that this was not a literal star, because how could you have a literal star? Now, when it can appear as a star, an angel can, a special light in the skies there, and they realize that it's not one of the celestial stars out there, because they are, zillions of miles away. But something that they saw that was clear and obvious to them, and we believe certainly that it was an angel, because stars were always symbolic of angels. Holding your place here, if you look at Numbers chapter 24, when Balaam was forced to prophesy of the future of Jacob, of Israel, in Numbers 24 and in verse 17, breaking into that prophecy that began in verse 15, "I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star shall come out of Jacob. A scepter shall rise out of Israel and batter the brow of Moab and destroy the sons of tumult." Well, the latter half of that verse will take place at his second coming. But the fact of the first half of that verse is talking about his first coming and the star of Jacob that would come. And it's interesting, a star was used in fulfilling the prophecy there to lead these men to where he was born. Verse 3, "When Herod the king heard these things, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him," really upset. Well, because he was afraid that he was going to be overthrown. "And when he had gathered all the chief priests and scribes of the people together, he inquired of them where the Christ was to be born. And so they said to him, 'In Bethlehem of Judea, for it is written by the prophet, but you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are not the least among the rulers of Judah, for out of you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel.'" And that's taken from Micah in the Minor Prophets, Micah chapter 5 and in verse 2. Now, have you read anything yet about the date? What time of year is this? We haven't got a date for the birth yet, have we? And you're not going to get it either because it's just not there. Verse 7, then Herod, when he had secretly called the wise men, determined from them what time the star appeared. Now, you have to keep in mind, since they were coming from the east, and most likely they came across from the Euphrates, from Parthia, that takes time to get there. And so that's why he's inquiring, when did this first appear to you, that you began to see it? Well, they didn't just, last week see it and get over here. We're talking about months would take to when they first see it to come from the Euphrates River area all the way over to Jerusalem. And somehow there was some word that went out because Herod heard about it. He wanted to talk to them. And you kind of read between the lines here, there was more than what is actually written here. Verse 8, and he sent them to Bethlehem, and he said, go and search diligently for the young child, and when you have found him, bring back word to me that I may come and worship him also. And so he understood that this was one to worship him, to worship him. Well, I think even the Pharisees understood, and the Sadducees too. Who do you worship? You only worship God. You only worship God. They would have understood that you don't worship men and all of that. And yet here Herod understands that this king is more than just, a descendant of a Jewish king. And that is understood by the people to come. Yeah, tell me, so I can come worship him. Well, verse 9, and when they heard the king, they departed, and behold, the star which they had seen in the east went before them till it came and stood over where the young Christ was. Now, if it was if it departed which they had seen in the east, it was out in front leading them, wasn't it? Now, you wouldn't see the star in the daytime, would you? They must have been doing some traveling at night and moving at night. And here this light, which was really an angel, and it's not out there in the heavens. It's right here in the atmosphere. And it's leading them, and it's moving them down the road from Jerusalem to Bethlehem, which is about 5 miles, and taking them to the location. And as we, I think we'll read here in just a moment, it will hover over the manger where he was born. Actually, not over the manger, because he's already been born, but it will be over the house that they are now moved into or staying, whether it was some relatives, friends, we don't know. It doesn't tell us here. But let me just read on, verse 10. And when they saw the star, they rejoiced with exceedingly great joy. And when they had come into the house, they saw the young child with Mary, his mother, and fell down and worshipped him, and when they had opened their treasures, why would these Eastern kings, unless they had some knowledge and faith and belief of the Old Testament and the prophecies of the Old Testament, fall down and worship him? I don't believe any other king they fell down to worship. they may show respect, and of course they brought here the gifts, as you will read about, to give, but to fall down and worship. So these people knew something, these three wise men, but we don't know to what extent. Obviously, it had to be enough that they knew this was the coming of the Messiah. It wasn't just any king of the Jews. This was the king of the Jews, the Messiah. And verse 12, then being divinely warned in a dream, well, I should finish verse 11. And when they had opened their treasures, they presented gifts to him, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. These were precious things. Frankincense is used in the offerings in the Old Testament. And so it was something that goes back a long time. Gold was the most valuable of all metals. And myrrh, I'm not sure how myrrh was used, but these represented something that was very, very, expensive. Precious, all of that. And so they were presenting this to him as you would present an expensive and a gift out of respect to a king. Then being divinely warned in a dream that they should not return to Herod, they departed from their own country another way. Now, how does Matthew know all of these things to write it? Because Matthew wouldn't come along, or it'd be 30 years before Matthew is called by Christ to become one of his disciples. Well, just keep that question in your mind. Let's go on to verse 13. Now, when they had departed, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream, saying, "Arise, take the young child and his mother, and flee to Egypt, and stay there until I bring you word, for Herod will seek the young child to destroy him." And when he arose, he took the young child and his mother by night and departed for Egypt, and was there until the death of Herod, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by the Lord through the prophet, saying, "Out of Egypt I call my son." Now, there are two places in the Old Testament, really. The direct quote comes from Hosea chapter 11 and in verse 1. But if you also look here at Numbers 24 again, where Balaam was forced by God to prophesy about Jacob, there is a dualism in the previous prophecy in chapter 24. And you will find, when you look at verse 8, God brings him out of Egypt. He has strengthened he has strength like a wild ox, and shall consume the nations, his enemies, and he shall break their bones and pierce them with arrows, and so on. There is a dualism there, both for Jacob as a nation, and also for the one who would come out of Jacob, who will do some of these things in the latter half of verse 8, but at his second coming. And of course, that would be Christ, who likewise was to come out of Egypt, just as it said in Hosea 11 and verse 1 in the more specific prophecy about that. Verse 16, "Then Herod, when he saw that he was deceived by the wise men, was exceedingly angry, and he sent forth and put to death all the male children who were in Bethlehem and in all its districts, from 2 years old and under, according to the time which he had determined from the wise men." So 2 years have passed. That's why he was using 2 years from the time that they had first seen this. And the child had already been born. We'll see it in Luke's account, how it was born in the manger and everything. But the child had already been born, and the star was leading them from the eastern country that they came from. And it was a country that obviously had a heritage or background of some in the Old Testament. And when you read in Josephus that the descendants of the tribes that had gone into captivity, that many of them were east of the Euphrates, well, at that period of time, the only great nation east of the Euphrates was the Parthian Empire. And seems to be the preponderance of the evidence of where they would have come from. All right, let's see. A couple other things here, and I'll just move along. Let's finish up this chapter. Verse 17, "Then was fulfilled what was spoken by Jeremiah the prophet, saying that a voice was heard in Ramah, lamentation, weeping, and great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children." You know, Rachel died giving birth to Benjamin, where? At Bethlehem. You go back to the book of Genesis. And so Rachel weeping for her children, refusing to be comforted because they were no more. They had been taken. And that prophecy is in Jeremiah 31, and I think it is in verse 15. Now, verse 19, "But when Herod was dead, behold, the angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt, saying, 'Arise, take the young child and his mother, and go to the land of Israel, for those who sought the young child's life, there they are dead.' And then he arose, and he took the young child and his mother, and came into the land of Israel. And when he heard that Archelaus was reigning over Judea instead of his father Herod," Archelaus is also known as Herod Antipas, A-N-T-I-P-A-S. There are four Herods in the New Testament. Herod the Great was the one who had the children killed. Herod Antipas is this man right here called Archelaus, just another name for him, followed by Herod Agrippa the First and Herod Agrippa the Second, you find in the book of Acts. And Paul would later come before Herod Agrippa, I believe it was the Second. But when he heard that Archelaus was reigning over Judea instead of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there, and being warned by God in a dream, he turned aside into the region of Galilee. And he came and dwelt in the city called Nazareth, that is, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by the prophets, that he shall be called a Nazarene. Now, I don't know if that's anywhere in the Old Testament we know of. The one possible place where you could gather that from, Nazarene, would be Isaiah chapter 53 and in verse 3. All right, that takes care of Matthew's account of the birth of Jesus Christ. We don't see anything about December 25th. We don't see anything about winter, do we? We just see the story of the wise men who came. By the time they got there, he was no longer in a manger. He was in a house. And, of course, then they had to flee to Egypt. They were told, that is, the parents were, to take the child until Herod was dead. All right, let's take a look at Luke's account. And then we'll take a look at some other things here in Luke chapter 2. We won't read the whole chapter. Luke is a very good writer. He gives, I should mention on Matthew's account, because people doubt the story, that is, some people want to doubt the story. I saw it on the History Channel here two weeks ago or whatever it was, that there one of the individuals talking about the account doubted that it ever happened, that Herod killed the children, because we don't have any secular evidence that that ever took place. Well, there's a lot of things happen that we don't have secular evidence for. But when you see a writer write with the detail that is given there by Matthew, of what took place and how the star brought the angels, how that when and of course they had seen Herod, that knowledge was brought to Matthew to write that. They came down there. They brought the gifts to the house. All of that was given there. Where's he getting this information from? We're going to see in this chapter in Luke chapter 2. And then when he talks about how that when Herod realized that they had deceived him because they went a different route, they didn't go back through Jerusalem to head east. They took a different route to go east deliberately because the angel of the Lord told them to do that in a dream. All of these things. They told these things to Mary. There's a lot of things that these people obviously said that's not written there. But we do have enough detail. And then what Herod did, and specifically from 2 years and under. How many children was that? I don't know. how many escaped before they that all took place? Probably some did. So, but of course he was not there at the time. All right, now let's come back here to Luke chapter 2, verse 1. And it came to pass in those days that a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be registered. And, Caesar Augustus reigned from 29 B.C. to 14 A.D. And the census first took place when Quirinius was governing Syria. Now, here we're having some details that are being given by Luke that are quite interesting. Luke, as you might say, is almost like a historian. And these things have since been, at one time, census that during the time of Quirinius was doubted by people, but they have since discovered and realized in archaeology, Luke is right on. He has it exactly right. He gives very good detail, not only in the book of Luke, but also in the book of Acts, of the journeys and all the places they went to. And, I mean, it's perfectly accurate. Verse 3, so all went to be registered, everyone, to his own city. And Joseph also went up from Galilee, out of the city of Nazareth, into Judea, to the city of David, which is called Bethlehem, because he was of the house and lineage of David. So that's now we know why they were in Bethlehem when they actually lived in Nazareth. And to be registered with Mary, his betrothed wife, who was with child. And so it was that while they were there, the days were completed for her to be delivered. And verse 7, and she brought forth her firstborn son and wrapped him in swaddling clothes and laid him in a manger. Actually, it was a trough, a feeding trough, because there was no room for them in the inn. And the Greek word is kataluma. It was a guest chamber. That's what an inn was at that particular time. Now, why would the inn be totally filled up on December 25th? Is that the time of year that you're going to register people for taxation in the Roman Empire in that age, in that time? Would it not be smarter to do that after harvest? Well, yes. You don't do it in the dead of winter. And would there be that many people that would be there just to be registered whose descendancy would be out of Bethlehem? It seems rather unusual that you would have that many people there. I'll take some time here in a little bit to give you some of the evidences of the season of the year that we do have in the Bible. We don't have the date, but we can certainly look at the general season when he would have been born. And it's in the fall, very, very early fall of the year. And when we recognize that, you know there's more than one reason why the inn or the guest chamber would be filled. Because Josephus tells us at the feast, the spring feast of unleavened bread, as well as the feast in the fall, that Jerusalem was overfilled, 3 million people. And into the bordering little towns like Bethlehem, everything would be filled. Obviously, if you want to register people to tax them and everything, and you're a smart Roman, you're going to do it when, hey, you know, they're all going to be there. But the feast had not yet started, apparently, as we will see as we go along. But it must have been in that general season of the year. And I will, when I get done with this, we'll take a look at some of the scriptures that talk about the time and the season when it would have taken place. Okay, let me move along. So this is the only place where we see that he was born in the manger. The manger scene, you know, all the Christmas manger scenes and everything. Well, by the time the wise men got to him, or got there, he was still in Bethlehem, wasn't he? They didn't just get up and go back to Nazareth. Why'd they stay? Why would they stay? What if they've registered? What's the your home's back up north? Could there have been a feast? What did they do? We know when he was 12 years old. Did they keep Passover at Nazareth, or did they come to Jerusalem? They came to Jerusalem for the days of unleavened bread, didn't they? And the Passover. So, okay, now coming back here, let's take a look at verse 8. Now there were in the same country shepherds living out in the fields, keeping watch over their flocks by night. And behold, an angel of the Lord stood before them, and the glory of the Lord shone around them, and they were greatly afraid. And then the angel said to them, "Do not be afraid, for behold, I bring you good tidings of great joy, which will be to all people. For there is born to you this day in the city of David a Savior who is Christ the Lord." So there is born to you this day, December 25th. Why would the shepherds on December 25th be out there freezing to death in the fields? And when you read anything, excuse me, about the custom of the shepherds staying in the field in the early fall, they bring them in because it turns cold. Now, where is Jerusalem and Bethlehem, which is 5 miles south of Jerusalem, where are they located? In the Judean mountains. And Jerusalem is, what, 2,800 feet above sea level. Bethlehem, I think, is probably the same, right in that, because they're both on that. We went by road down there when we were there years ago, and I don't remember going downhill or anything, but they should still basically about the same altitude from sea level. Well, in the wintertime and overnight, it's going to be very cold. It snows in Jerusalem some winters, not every winter. But we've had, I think we have some pictures from our trip of showing that we bought when Jerusalem would have snow and it'd be freezing. In December and January are certainly months like that. I recall when we were there for the Passover season, just before the Passover came. I can remember it was pretty brisk and chilly one of the evenings, or the next morning, actually. Especially when we went, I think it was up north, where I noticed that it's still at that time of year coming into spring. Still would be pretty cool. You wouldn't want to sit out there watching sheep at night, I don't think. because you better have some pretty good clothing on. You have a good campfire going or whatever. Verse 12, and this will be the sign, as the angel said to them, you will find a babe wrapped in swaddling clothes lying in a manger. So remember, it was on this day, the day of the birth, so they haven't moved to the house yet. And suddenly there was with the angel a multitude of the heavenly host praising God and saying, glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace and goodwill toward men, which I believe is better translated toward men of goodwill. That would be a better rendering of that particular verse. Well, they came and they made that announcement to the shepherds to come and to see that, yes, indeed, he was born. Well, what day was that? Some people want to insist, well, here we are. This was, I had years ago, a person wanted to argue over this. See, this right here says we're supposed to keep his birthday. No, it doesn't. What did they just do? They just said that, you can read it again, a multitude of heavenly hosts praising God and saying, happy birthday. No, glory to God in the highest, and on earth, peace, and to men of goodwill, I think is how it should be better rendered. So it was that when the angels had gone away from them into heaven, that the shepherds said to one another, let us now go to Bethlehem and see this thing that has come to pass, which the Lord has made known to us. And so they came with haste and found Mary and Joseph and the babe lying in a manger. And somehow they had to know exactly where this manger was located to find them, I would think. there's a lot of people there. We know the guest chambers are full. So, you know, it's, I was going to say it's almost kind of like day before Christmas in Miami when everybody's moving around. The traffic was quite horrendous yesterday out there on that freeway. But anyhow, coming back here, so they had to know, somebody had to tell them or direct them in some way how to find this particular manger or where it was. Maybe they knew because that might have been where animals were generally kept, all in one place. So, verse 18, and all those who heard it marveled at those things which were told them by the shepherds. But Mary, now here, notice this, but Mary kept all these things and pondered them in her heart. She kept the details. And the shepherds returned, glorifying and praising God for all the things that they had heard and seen as it was told. Now, notice if you turn the page over here to verse 51, then he went down to them and came to Nazareth and was subject to them. But his mother kept all these things in her heart. Now, twice Luke has made that statement. So what is Luke telling us? He's telling us, I interviewed Mary. She's my source. She's the one I'm quoting the story from. And not just quoting her verbatim as far as the general story. Because if she hadn't kept it in her heart, the details, how would I, Luke, even know what to write? That also tells us about Matthew, because Matthew is one of the 12. Luke was not. So Matthew had access to Mary through John, because John took care of Mary. And so he was able to write all of this. And otherwise, he wouldn't have been able to write, I'm sure, all of the details of Jesus' birth and what took place. So he got part of it, and actually Luke fills in the rest of it. because he writes later. And but it is a very interesting and detailed account. So from these two accounts, Mark and John do not write about the birth of Christ. We can see that it doesn't give us the specific date when this took place. And it tells that we don't see anything. There was no Christmas trees. There was no mistletoe. There were no special lights. There were gifts that were given to the king by the wise men. You notice that the shepherds didn't have any gifts. Of course, it was just that very day. They didn't have any time to prepare. So they weren't able to do that. All right, now, with some of the background in mind, let's take a look at the question, does the Bible condone adopting pagan customs into true worship of God? Now, we've looked at what is the true story in the two accounts, which are the only two accounts in the Bible about it. What about the remainder, the other bigger question? Because in the very beginning, why does everybody do all these things? You know, it's kind of funny. People don't stop to think what they're saying. A gentleman yesterday from the funeral home stood up and talked about the resurrection of the dead and representing the funeral home and giving acknowledgments. And after he quoted that John 11, I am the resurrection, then he went right on into the fact that Karen's up there in heaven. And, you know, wait a minute. It's either or, it can't be both. And that's I bring that up because I think it's the same way over these things that you see. I read this, these things, these articles from the paper and so forth. I bet you the authors of the articles are keeping Christmas, if I was to bet on it. They know, well, it's like the book I quoted to you a few years ago, 4,000 Years of Christmas. There's two authors. They go back through all the way back to 2000 B.C. in Babylon in 4,000 Years of Christmas. And talk about it clear back at the time when Abraham was in Ur of the Chaldees. And showing all of these things, and isn't interesting and novel. And then the ending of the book is how wonderful it is that I'm paraphrasing, of course, have this understanding as we keep his birthday today. Somehow it doesn't compute, does it? Well, let's go back here to look at a few scriptures. I'm reminded, really, to many of us. But let's go to Deuteronomy chapter 12. Deuteronomy chapter 12. And it may have been a while since you've looked at some of these. But they're certainly very, very much extant for us today. In Deuteronomy chapter 12 and verse 30 and 31, take heed to yourself that you are not ensnared to follow them after they are destroyed from before you, and that you do not inquire after their gods, saying, well, how did these nations serve their gods? I also will do likewise. You shall not worship the Lord your God in that way. For every abomination of the Lord, which he hates, they have done to their gods, and for they burn even their sons and daughters in the fires to their gods. So whatever I command you, be careful to observe it. You shall not add to it nor take away from it. Well, when Jesus Christ came, we could disregard that, right? He fulfilled it for us. And so we can go ahead and borrow all of these pagan customs. We will just Christianize it because, of course, we're not really, we're keeping it for Christ. Now, that kind of reasoning is absurd to all of you, I know. And people don't stop to want to face up to what it is that they're actually saying or the reasonings that they're using. How would this no longer pertain to us today in the New Testament? Jesus didn't give his life as a sacrifice for the sins of all of mankind, so that mankind can now bring all those pagan customs into Christianity and worship him with them. That doesn't make any sense at all. It's ridiculous. We see it after they came into the promised land in Joshua chapter 23. In Joshua 23 and verses 6 and through 8. In Joshua 23, verse 6. Therefore, be very courageous to keep and to do all that is written in the book of the law of Moses, lest you turn aside from it to the right hand or to the left, and lest you go among these nations, these who remain among you, you shall not make mention of the name of their gods, nor cause anyone to swear by them. You shall not serve them, nor bow down to them, but you shall hold fast to the Lord your God, as you have done to this day. Well, we don't bow down to them, but you serve them by putting them up every year. And going through all of that, whether you even know what you're doing, and most people don't, they're just simply doing it. But as I said at the beginning, they probably don't really, a lot of people really don't want to know what it is. Let's go along here to Jeremiah chapter 10, which in the Charlie Brown cartoon was quoted. We have, over the years, had it in our booklet on Christmas many years ago. And whether this tree was exactly like the Christmas trees or evergreens are today, I don't know, but it certainly points out a couple facts here. They're very, very similar. Hear the word which the Lord speaks to you, O house of Israel. Thus says the Lord. It's interesting. O house of Israel. Does the house of Judah put up a tree? No. They keep Hanukkah. Right? The Jewish people don't put up Christmas trees. And he says here, O house of Israel. Now, when you look at later scriptures, particularly in Ezekiel 37 and in Zechariah chapter 10, you see at the time of the end, there are two houses. You have the house of Israel and the house of Judah. The two sticks, remember, come together, Ezekiel 37, the house of Israel, the house of Judah, and become one when what? David is resurrected and Jesus returns. Now, this one is interesting. He says, O house of Israel. Well, you think about it. We're about what we are about to read. You don't see this today that I'm aware of from the house of Judah. Going on, thus says the Lord, do not learn the ways of the Gentiles. Do not be dismayed at the signs of heaven. For the Gentiles are dismayed at them. They get into the astrology stuff and all of that. Of course, we have a lot of people involved in that. You find it in the newspaper every day too, right? Verse 3, for the customs of the people are futile. For one cuts a tree from the forest, the work of the hands of the workmen with the axe. They decorate it with silver and gold, and they fasten it with nails and hammers so that it will not topple. And they are upright like a palm tree is upright, and they cannot speak. They must be carried because they cannot go by themselves. Do not be afraid of them, for they cannot do evil, nor can they do any good. So we do the same thing today as apparently they were doing back in 600 B.C. when Jeremiah wrote and lived. And yes, if it was wrong for him to do it then, why would it be right for us to do it now? Well, obviously not. A couple others, I think, in Ezekiel chapter 20. Why isn't it just, what's wrong with giving gifts? I mean, it's so wonderful to give gifts. Well, actually, it isn't wrong to give gifts. It has to do with the occasion and what you're giving them for, though. And here in Ezekiel chapter 20 and in verse 39, and as for you, O house of Israel, again, he leaves the house of Judah out of this, thus says the Lord God, go serve every one of you his idols and hereafter, and if you will not obey me and but profane my holy name, no more with your gifts and your idols. Now, they were giving gifts. The giving of gifts is not wrong. We find a lot about giving of gifts in the New Testament, don't we? And helping others and so on. But obviously, it had to do with the worshiping of their idols and the things that were not right that they gave gifts. And all of the interesting pagan celebrations and so forth that they had, as far as on occasions, were all accompanied with the giving of gifts. Let's look at Malachi. Malachi chapter 3, and notice something here, last book of the Old Testament. Malachi 3 and in verse 6, for I am the Lord, I do not change, Therefore, you are not consumed, O house of Jacob. Then he goes on and goes into tithing, as I think you're probably familiar with there. But that statement, that I am the Lord and I do not change. If I didn't want my people involved, I'm a jealous God, and I do not want them involved with the things that come from the worship of demons, pagan idols, and that type of thing. Why would I want them after I send my son to be a sacrifice for all their sins, that suddenly these things are just very permissible to make as a part of their life? Well, the warnings that were given in the Old Testament certainly apply to us today in the New. In Mark chapter 7 is another scripture that's, I think, very important to consider in this. People should. It's nice to be able to talk with you. I'm preaching to the choir here. Because if I was speaking out publicly on these things, I'm sure I would be starting to get some unfriendly looks at me. But here in Mark chapter 7, verse 6 and 7, the issue had to do, of course, with the way they were to wash their hands by the customs of the priests and so forth, as well as also the gift of Corban is brought up. But the statement that Jesus uses in answering them, I think, is worth looking at. Let's go to verse 6 and 7. He answered and he said to them, "Well did Isaiah prophesy of you hypocrites, as it is written, 'This people honors me with their lips,' and our people do today too, 'but their heart is far from me.' Why is it? Well, because they don't want to obey me. And in vain they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men." Now that certainly applies to many of our customs today that people do. Yes, they give great lip service to God. They want to put manger scenes up in front and on public lands, and they go to court with the ACLU and see if they can win or whatever to keep it there and all those things. But a lot of great lip service, but their heart is far from me. Their heart is far from me. So if we're going to try to justify things that God says are an abomination to him, I never wanted you to do those things or to even bring those things into your homes or to anything like that whatsoever. That's not how you worship me. That's not how you worship my son. One that's very important here, and then I'm going to move into something else very quickly to finish up, that is in John chapter 4. John 4. This certainly does apply to this time of year. It applies on all subjects, frankly, but certainly here it does. And when he was speaking to the woman at the well, who had trouble telling the truth at times, but in John chapter, chapter 4, verse 23 and 24, verse 23, "But the hour is coming, and now is, when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth, for the Father is seeking such to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth." Now, how people can bring all that kind of stuff into their homes and participate in that and say that they are worshiping in spirit and truth? Because, as you know, they are not. That is not worshiping in spirit and truth. And the truth is that it's not the truth and getting into that type of thing. One other one, I'm kind of watching my time. I'll list you a couple other ones that would in the New Testament that would go along with this. Galatians 4 and verses 8 through 10 about the seasons, the times, the months, and so forth. Verse 8 of Galatians 4 shows that it had to do with going back to worshiping of those things that are not gods, the demons, and things of demonic worship. Maybe I should turn there because real quickly, and then I'll move along. Here in Galatians chapter 4 and verses 8 through 10. "But then, indeed, when you did not know God, you served those which by nature are not gods." What would that be? When you did not know God, you served those which by nature were not gods. Well, serving the demons and the pagan religions of that area of Galatia. "But now, after you have known God, or rather are known by God, how is it that you turn again to the weak and beggarly elements?" Now, it's important to look at a commentary on that, because the weak and beggarly elements it refers also up to verse 3, where you see we're in bondage under the elements of the world. No, the word means spirits. The stoika is in the Greek and means the spirits, the evil spirits of the world. And so when you understand that in verse 9, then you know what it's referring to in verse 8, right? It's the King James is very poor here. It's the weak and the beggarly elements are the spirits of this world. That's what it's really referring to, Paul was. And so what they were worshiping in verse 8, previous to that, were the spirits of the demon religions that they had been called out of. And they were beginning to go back to those things. And verse 10, you observe days, months, seasons, and years. That's according to their pagan calendars. That's not the Jewish calendar or the Hebrew calendar there in verse 10. Because that is not, you don't find that in the Old Testament. But they were going back to a different calendar and keeping those events and so forth. And one last one I think is worth turning to is Hebrews 13 on this portion. Hebrews 13, verses 8 through 9. Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever, which agrees with Malachi 3 and verse 6. I do not change. All right? I do not change. So, yes, he's the same today as he was in that respect in the Old Testament. And we are to worship Jesus Christ. We are to worship our Father in heaven in spirit and in truth, not in these things that are came from the worship of demons and that type of thing. I've got a few minutes, maybe very few. So when was Christ actually born? We don't know the date, do we? But there are a couple things that we can learn from it. One of them I actually read, but without actually going through and answering it completely. Let me just give it to you. In Luke chapter 2, verses 1 through 5, I read that earlier to you. Judea, of course, was a protectorate. Taxation took place after the harvest. That's when the Romans would do it. And Herod, in particular, followed Jewish custom for taxing. Mary, by the way, was not required to be there to register for taxation, but Joseph was. So the question is, why was Mary there? Why didn't she stay back with the rest of the family in Nazareth? but she came anyhow. We find, as I mentioned to you, but it's in the, I said Antiquities, but it's actually in the Josephus' book called Wars of the Jews. And this quote, "For the whole multitude were gone up to Jerusalem to the Feast of Tabernacles." And when the Feast of Tabernacles, or as he also in another place mentions the Spring Feast, the overflow was enormous. Upwards of 3 million people would be there when they all came in. You know, on the day of Pentecost, and you read there in chapter 2, where all the Jewish people came from all over the Roman provinces. And, of course, they were speaking the dialect of where they came from, and they heard Peter speaking to them in their dialect or language. At that time. But why were those weren't Romans coming up there. They were people who were part of the Jewish diaspora, the dispersion. And they came because Pentecost, as we call it today, was one of the pilgrimage festivals to come to and come to Jerusalem. That's why Paul, many times, he wanted to be at Jerusalem for the three pilgrimage festivals, Passover, Unleavened Bread, Pentecost, or Tabernacles. And so we know that the time or the season when they would have done this, because Herod did it right after taxation, means early fall, not spring, as some have said. another one, which I've already read, and I'm just going to refer you back to it, is in Luke 2, verse 6 and 7. The inn was full, and of course the question I raised as we read it was why. the Greek word kataluma is guest chamber, which was used at the feasts. It was used at the feasts. If it was December 24th, 25th, in that range of time, why would you have the guest chambers totally filled up? There should have been plenty of room if that was the time and the date. Well, it wasn't. It was the early fall, the time that Herod wanted the taxation to take place, following that kind of Jewish custom. Also in Luke chapter 1, the most definite evidence of this time of year is given in Luke chapter 1, verses 5 through 9. There we see that that Zechariah, I should turn to that so I don't mess it up here, but Zacharias, and I'll make it as fast as I can, as I've done this before, but in Luke chapter 1, Zacharias, verse 8, there was in the days of Herod the king of Judea a certain priest named Zacharias of the division of Abijah. Now, that's very important to understand when Jesus was born, exactly. Let me just tell you, without taking a lot of time to go read through all of that, King David had to divide up the Levites when they would serve in the temple, or actually the tabernacle, later the temple under Solomon, because there were too many. You know, you get too many volunteers, they get in each other's way. And that's what had happened by the time of David. So he divided them up into these courses. And the course that Zacharias came under was that called Abijah. They served twice a year. And each one served I think it was 2 weeks each in the 6 months. And then in the second 6 months, again, they would serve. All the courses, I think it's 24 courses, that they all served at the holy days, the three pilgrimage holy days of spring, summer, and fall. So actually that meant that they would be serving at least three times during the year. When you count, well, more than that, five times during the year that they'd be serving when you count the holy days as well. Now we know that John, as you read chapter 1 of Luke and go through it, that after he came out of the serving his course, the course of Abijah for the first half of the year or the beginning of the year would have taken place somewhere around June. And when he came back, it was not long after he came back to his home that Elizabeth conceived. Now, she was 6 months ahead of Mary when she gave birth to John the Baptist. Now, from, let's say, the end of June, and you go forward 9 months, it'll take you around to around March, end of March, maybe 1st of April, when John was born. And you will note here about verse 26 on that it says that she was 6 months ahead of Mary. And so Mary would give birth to Christ 6 months after John. Well, if we can pinpoint when John was born, the season and time of the year, by the course of Abijah, when Zechariah came from the temple after serving his course, and he went back home, his wife then soon conceived, as you will see as you read the chapter, and that was 6 months ahead of Mary. So that means 9 months from somewhere around the end of June, let's say, in that period of time, to the 1st of July, it's going to take you 9 months to the spring of the next year. And that will be around either late March, maybe 1st of April. Well, go 6 months ahead, and you're going to be coming to the early fall when Mary is giving birth to Christ. So all of these things point to the early fall of when Jesus was born. It wasn't in the dead of winter. It wasn't in the middle of the summer. It wasn't at any of the two solstices. It wasn't in the spring. Some churches actually teach that it was in the spring of the year, but we have to do something for Christ, so we keep Christmas. And I agree, we do have to do something for Christ, and that is to obey him and obey what he has taught us and throughout both the Old and in the New Testament. So that was just kind of quickly going through it as far as the biblical evidence of the season or the time of the year when he would have been born. But I think if we look at all of these things and realize that the customs that are so common, which I think all of us in this room realize, are not Christian, they are not, they simply are a name, but they are not when it comes to what the Bible describes. hopefully, as a result, we look at this as a reminder, and so we understand the true story of Christmas and what it is not, and what the truth is of the birth of Jesus Christ.